A very warm welcome. You're listening to Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost, here with you every weekday from 9 until 1 on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up, talking through the stories they've been tackling this week. Today I'm joined by editor Simon Lambert and journalist Rich Browning. On the agenda today, the EU eats your club card points.
Card firms are going to be earning less. So they're trying to retract that cash in other ways that they can, and that means axing or decreasing the value of their loyalty or cashback schemes.
Is banking tech moving too quickly? Contactless payments soar as the amount we can swipe goes up 50%. But can we opt out? It all comes just days after HSBC and NatWest suffered IT glitches over the bank holiday weekend, leaving over 275,000 customers without pay.
Well, something like payment not going into your account will clearly have a negative effect. You getting online and having a look at your statements can have serious consequences on being able to budget.
Also today, lenders get personal. Will you have to take a psychometric test to get a loan, a credit card or a mortgage? Leasehold, a great idea or just a lucrative way to stop people from buying their own homes outright? Also, unclaimed luggage, surplus government equipment or goods seized by the police? We find out how to bag a posh bargain at auction. Now, whether it's yachts, parking or yoga and green juice, we take a look at some entrepreneurs with business ideas and no prizes for guessing which franchise is going to be a force to be reckoned with this Christmas. Yes, I really am that predictable that as much as possible I try and play the theme tune to Star Wars. Research at the Autumn Fair in Birmingham predicts that Star Wars merchandise will be at the top of the most wanted charts for Christmas. Today, indeed, it's Force Friday. According to Disney, brought out the Lucasfilm franchise for $4 billion. Yes, stores in the UK opened at midnight to launch the Star Wars The Force Awakens merchandise.
But yogurt, what is this place? What is it that you do here? Merchandising.
Merchandising? What's that?
Merchandising! Where the real money from the movie is made.
Where the real money from the movie is made. Yes, you cannot blame Disney either, even though Force Friday is a bit of a ridiculous name. Fans have spent $20 billion, $20 billion on Star Wars merchandise since the first film came out in 1977. So we've been asking today for your favourite bit of movie memorabilia that you might have. Perhaps it's something from your younger years you remember fondly, a bedspread perhaps, or something you have now, you know, in a glass cabinet maybe. Or are you just not into movie memorabilia whatsoever, think it's a complete waste of money, and the most you've got is the DVD on your shelf? I come straight to you, Simon.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I did confess just before we went on air that I wasn't sure I actually had any movie memorabilia. But that's not to say that when I was a kid, I didn't love it. My favourite thing when I was a kid was my X-Wing, basically Luke Skywalker's yep. X-Wing. That was basically my favourite toy. And I always lusted after a Millennium Falcon. But I haven't kept the merch on a shelf to gaze at or kept it in its box and never played with. However, I do have a house that is full of that kind of stuff now because I have two children. So there's a couple of Frozen dresses, maybe a Snow White dress. It's like you try and bring them up to climb trees and ride skateboards and ride bikes and all they want to do is dress as a princess.
You're showing them the wrong movie. Show them Star Wars.
I tried to.
And they'll want to be Princess Leia, won't they?
Yes.
Yeah. I've got the original Star Wars figures by my bed. Oh, dear. We're getting an insight into my life right now.
Morning, Georgie.
Good morning, Rich.
You're steering this towards Star Wars, and my Star Wars story sadly involves... I used to own the complete collection of Marvel Star Wars comics that I collected as and when they came out from 1977, and my mum threw them away. So... that's not my cherished movie memorabilia, but I do collect, if you like, original copies of screenplays.
Oh, fantastic.
And my favourite one, I think, Sunset Boulevard. Just an astonishing piece of writing that if you teach yourself how to read screenplays and visualise the movie as you're reading it, it's actually better than watching the film because I have the concentration span of a... staple.
So should we be telling this to all those people who are going to be queuing up to watch Star Wars in the cinema? You basically, when they buy their ticket, they get ushered into a room and told, actually, you're not going to watch the film. Here's the screenplay. Read it. Trust me, it's better.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome. This is Share Radio here on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, in the studio with me, talking over some of the stories they've been looking at over the last 7 days since we last met. And today, I'm joined by editor Simon Lambert, journalist Rich Browning, and coming up, Tesco, well, they get a little bit stingy with their club card points, but it's not their fault, apparently. But first, do you remember a time when punching your PIN in at the supermarket or perhaps a restaurant was a big shiny new thing in spending? Well, how quickly technology moves on. The UK Card Association said we spent £2.5 billion on contactless cards in the first 6 months of this year alone, and this week the amount we can swipe away from our accounts went up from £20 to £30, although we are being warned to be a little bit patient. Not all shops can accept the higher cap straight away as terminals and need to be updated. But there are issues inevitably about security. A witch investigation showed scanners can be used to swipe our details, which has apparently led some people to cover their wallets in foil. And yet, the cards keep on being sent out by the banks. Now, this all comes as banking tech is increasingly under the spotlight. Thousands unable to use their cards after two separate computer glitches over the bank holiday weekend. But we won't concentrate on that just yet. Firstly, Simon, let's focus on the rise of contactless. Why has it grown so fast? Now, I've had contactless on my Barclay card for years, but only recently does it seem that everybody is swiping to pay. Is it simplicity? Simon, is it the fact that you can now use it perhaps on the London Underground, or because card companies are just pushing it out on us even more?
Okay, well, the last bit of that is actually quite an important factor, I think. Contactless has been massively pushed by the banks and the credit card companies, and they've been making quite a fuss about this for a number of years. And in fact, we took them to task some years ago because there were all kinds of claims about the number of transactions going through, and they were really, really bragging about this and boasting about it. Yet people just really didn't seem to be that interested. Now, I think what's changed the game is contactless debit cards. So contactless credit cards, I was always a bit suspicious that this was just a ruse by credit card companies to make it easier to spend money on your credit card, therefore they could make more money in interest off the people who don't clear their bills in full every month. Debit cards, though, that's just your money from your bank that you're spending. Unless you're ending up in an overdraft and being charged some interest, which I suppose makes the bank some money, they don't really make any extra money off that extra spending. And it is just a lot easier. So to be honest, I'm a fan of contactless cards. And the place where I am a real fan is the ability to use it on the tube, basically, rather than having to load up an Oyster card. So I think that for people within London or travelling within London, it's a bit more of a game changer than it is if you're in the rest of the country.
Rich, is it the end of cold, hard cash?
I hope so. I think we should support the banks in all these enterprises, because if the banks don't do it, and we kind of trust the banks even though they're all... It's so convenient, and if you imagine the future, then it's only going to get more convenient and easier and hopefully completely secure.
What protections do you have in place if your card is stolen or something goes wrong with it? Because, of course, you can only spend £30 in one transaction, but that's not to stop someone running off and spending £30 all over the shop.
No, that's true. And so this is where a lot of people are concerned about contactless cards, isn't it? Is that they're worried about the security involved. And if you don't have to put a PIN in, all you have to do is tap it. Someone gets your card, off they go, around the shops, tap, 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 tap,
exactly.
Tap, tap. Ooh, some stuff for me. And then it's up to you to then sort of chase that money back. And if you are defrauded and someone has stolen your card, then the bank should refund you the money. You should be protected. And they can't turn around and say, oh, well, they must have found out your PIN, because in this instance, the PIN wasn't used. So I do get why people are concerned about it. And there's this other bit of concern. Hackers are able to go around and essentially have this technology, which means that basically you can read the details from the contactless card, they can take your details, and then they can go off and spend lots of money. And this is where the lining your wallet with tinfoil thing comes in. And I can understand why people are concerned about this, and they've got every right to be concerned about this, and they shouldn't be called Luddites for voicing these concerns. Mm-hmm. And if people don't want a contactless card, they should be able to ask for it. And this is what this story was about here, that Lee looked into, was he said, actually, contrary to popular belief and what the banks would have you believe, if you don't want a contactless card, you can contact them and say, I don't want one. Now, some of our readers have said, well, I tried that, and they said, no, you have to have a contactless card. So Harold Silver in London says, contrary to what this article says, Barclays refused to issue non-contactless cards to their Premier customers. Mint do the same. So customers can ask, but whether they will get very much depends on who you bank with. And then another reader, Slacker in Edinburgh, offers the opposing view where he says, Halifax are sending me a non-contactless card. No problem getting one once I'd battled through the automatic telephone to actually speak to someone. And funnily enough, I wrote something about this a number of years ago when Barclaycard sent me my contactless card. And this was before you could use your debit cards on the tube and the bus. But these Barclaycard contactless cards could be used only on London buses. So what I used to do is, as most people would do before the contactless card, I had my Oyster card in my wallet and I just tap my wallet on the reader. Well, lo and behold, I got my Barclaycard bill and I'd run up sort of £12.50's worth of bus fares. I was like, I didn't want to do this. I didn't want to spend this money. So I contacted TfL and I contacted Barclaycard. It turned out that if your Barclaycard, your contactless Barclaycard, was in the same wallet as your Oyster card, there was no way of the bus reader knowing it should read the Oyster card, not the credit card. So I said, well, can I have a non-contactless card? And Barclaycard said, no, we don't do them. I said, well, what am I supposed to do? I said, you know, I don't want to be spending bus fares on my contactless card. And they suggested I could get another wallet and carry two wallets.
That's nice of them to say that, but do listen out. They do on the Underground say, watch out for Card Clash.
Well, that was before. That was just as Card Clash was emerging. I'd like to say that This Is Money was one of the first places to report the problem of Card Clash.
There we go. But let's turn our attention, shall we, on the same theme, banking tech. HSBC and NatWest suffering IT glitches over the bank holiday, which left 275,000 customers without their wages. Now, in July, millions of bank customers at Nationwide and NatWest were left unable to access cash or found they'd been overcharged after a severe computer problem, which came just weeks again after a bungled software update left millions of NatWest and RBS customers unable to pay bills or move their money. Well, we spoke to debt expert Carl Packman about the impact that these so-called glitches can have for those who are perhaps already struggling.
Well, something like payments not going into your account will clearly have a negative effect on your balances and on your ability to spend at all. The other thing with regards to getting online and having a look at your finances, your statements, for example, can have serious consequences on your being able to budget, especially over bank holiday weekend when we're spending a bit more. And all but one of the bank holiday weekend days was nice, so people were going out spending. Yeah, that could have had a knock-on effect if you went back and had a look at your balance at the end of the day and it was all skewed.
So, Rich, it does feel potentially like this tech is all moving very, very quickly. Like I said right at the start there, it wasn't so long ago where pins were the new shiny thing. Too quickly?
I think they like to present this image that tech's moving really quickly, but in the background there's some computers that seriously need updating.
Well, that's the thing, it's too quick for the fact that their creaking system isn't doing some of the basic things.
Well, we've said this before, these are those running off the back of many major companies' payroll systems and some of the banking system.
Yeah.
Is these old-fashioned computers with a sort of green flashing cursor. And it's really difficult if you've got that legacy system, like Rich said, to upgrade off the back of it. So whilst your mobile phone or your internet banking might look all whizzy and shiny, the stuff that it's running off is very, very creaky.
Which is a little bit worrying. And I mentioned loads of situations there, Rich, and I'm sure they go back far further than that.
I think you know, these banks have to push this stuff, because if they don't, somebody else will, and it probably won't be as good, you know, and things do go wrong. We know that computers crash and it's how they deal with that, which I think is part of the problem. You know, the thing at the weekend where people weren't being paid, it was like, oh, whatever, we've got money. But so I wouldn't let that stop the future happening.
Well, I can say, is that the problem? We're all very happy with our contactless cards here, I imagine, in this room, and with the way that we can now bank on our mobiles. Do we have to sort of accept that, well, things are going to go wrong when so much money is being dealt with online now?
So long as the banks take responsibility and, you know, if your bank account's cleared out because you accidentally tapped your phone on a bus and they'll give you that back, I think that's fine. I think that's a sort of fair way to do it. I know the vast majority of people won't probably agree with that and would rather hand cash over on the bus now, but you can't. So. I love the idea. I'm just experimenting at the moment how long I can do my commute without carrying a bag. And I love the idea that you've got everything you need on your phone.
That makes me a little bit nervous because I'm sort of one of these people that's not perhaps the most responsible with things like that.
One of the things I like, so I don't have this Apple iPay or whatever this fancy new technology is. I don't know. What are they going to think of next?
Two wallets.
No, but the one thing I do like about this is actually the ability to have extra emergency ways to pay. So I wouldn't mind having that Apple iPay thing and being able to pay with my phone for the instances when you get somewhere and you realise that you've forgotten your wallet. So I've actually, with my contactless cards now, because you can use them on the tube, I've put a contactless card for a bank account that I don't use into one of my bags, so that if I ever go down to the tube station and I've forgotten my wallet, because it will normally be because I'm getting the tube to work rather than cycling, I'll be carrying that bag. I've now hidden a bank card in that bag, so I won't get there and find I can't get the tube, because I have got to the tube before and then had to go all the way home to get my wallet.
Sort of an obsessive compulsive thing we've got.
Yeah, yeah, I'm just going to start.
Also, not everybody knows where you're keeping your bank
cards. It's possibly not security conscious, but I'm just going to start hiding bank cards all over the country that I can use.
I have got £10 note folded up in my phone case.
Rich thought of Apple iPay first. He's folded up a £10 note in his phone case.
One last question on this before we do move on is there is a little bit more serious issue in terms of high street stores, small businesses and the like. If they don't keep up with this technology, will they fall by the wayside?
Yes, they will. And actually, there's a serious point to be made here, which is that there's not a very level playing field for small shops and small high street businesses, in that they end up shouldering a proportionately much higher charge for processing payments than Tesco or Sainsbury's do. And that holds them back from getting things like contactless readers or letting you pay by card or telling you that you have to pay an extra 40p if you want to pay by card. And I think that that is something that needs to be addressed, because actually contactless payments and things like that have the ability to really boost business for small businesses, because it makes it much easier to spend there. And let's face it, loads of people don't have cash in their pockets nowadays. Some of the stuff that's going on around the technology of like little portable readers that they can do, companies like PayPal are doing some really interesting stuff with things like that. That's good. But ultimately, the banking system still depends on these massive... Depends on Visa, basically, doesn't it? So
that voice you're hearing, editor Simon Lambert, also in the studio with me, journalist Rich Browning from This Is Money. And continuing with the shopping on credit theme, bad news this week for millions of Tesco credit card holders. Now, the supermarket giant has halved the club card points you can get outside their stores. So now you'll earn just one penny per £8 spent. It's as a result, say Tesco, of new European laws. Earlier we spoke about this with Hannah Maundrell from money.co.uk, who told us more about why this is coming in.
This is happening because of an EU ruling that's capping the amount that providers can charge retailers for using their technology to process transactions. Now, at the moment, shops pay about 0.7% per credit card transaction to credit card companies, but from October this will drop to 0.3%. It's said to cost the credit card industry about £2.4 billion. Now, the move is designed to cut costs for retailers in the hope that they'll pass these savings on to consumers, and that's really why the EU has done this. But in other countries where it's already been implemented, savings at the till have been minimal, because the cost of repricing for the sake of a few pence really outweighs the savings that consumers would make. And the sad fact is that we're seeing credit card companies pulling their cashback and reward deals instead. They say that providing the benefits are unsustainable. Other credit card companies have already started scrapping the cashback that they're paying to customers too. They seem to just be joining in with this. Tesco are having to cut costs, but with all the bad press that they've had of late, you'd think that they'd want to do all they can to keep their loyal customers happy.
So let's focus a little bit on this EU cap, meant to be good for consumers, meant to be good for retailers by cutting the costs, and yet we're seeing it have a very negative impact.
Well, it's having an impact on something that basically a system that was built on kickbacks. So when you spend some money in a shop, some of the
loyalty,
money...
Loyalty, I think they call it, isn't it, Simon? Not kickbacks.
Yeah, because it's kickbacks, isn't it? It's you know what this is like many loyalty schemes. Ultimately, if you join a loyalty scheme and you get some form of points or some form of benefit, then ultimately, if you make sure that you're the kind of person who will use those points and use that benefit, then you're getting something as a little bonus, a little extra for free. And if you're getting something as a little bonus and a little extra for free, who's paying for it? Somebody must be paying for it, so the people who are paying for it are all the other people. Now, many people will probably have thought that these sort of the points and things were paid for out of the interest rate on the credit card, for example. But actually, what the banks have turned around and said is it's been coming from these interchange fees, and sorry, they've been cut. We can't keep giving you these bonuses.
Isn't it, though? Yes, agreed, someone has to pay for this, but isn't a lot of the point of loyalty points and cards, etc., was so that basically they can harvest your data as well? So they do get paid in that regard.
Ah, well, that's the club. That's just the club card, though. So that's just if you've just got a club card that you're spending in Tesco shops. And when you do your shopping, you swipe your club card. It doesn't pay for the shopping, but it basically says to Tesco, here's my data.
Yeah, exactly.
send me a voucher for a free pint of milk, kind of thing, or some money off some wine next time round. And people do like that. Club card's been a colossal success for Tesco. But with the credit cards, it's different. It's I'm going to spend with this card, and in return for spending with this card, you will give me X. Now, obviously, the way the credit card system works is the reason why you can get a balance transfer and borrow interest-free for 3 years is because somewhere down the line, there's a lot of people who don't pay off that money interest-free over the 3 years, and they get charged lots of money, and that subsidises the people who are sensible enough to pay the money off in 3 years. So you might rightly think that it's the same thing for the loyalty points, be it, you know, club card or airline or just cashback, basically. But actually, what the credit card industry is saying is a lot of that cashback and reward stuff is coming from these interchange fees. So I don't know, the difficulty is that once you build a business based on a certain thing happening, if you take that thing away, businesses don't like to see their margins cut into, so they basically take it off the consumer.
But also imagine Tesco as a credit card hasn't been around perhaps as long as the others, not so established. People perhaps would have gone to get a Tesco credit card for that reason alone. They must be feeling pretty duped about this, I guess. Well, have Tesco offered anything to their disappointed customers, do we know?
What they've done is they've just reduced the number of points, so you'll just get less points. And ultimately, I think it means
they've done nothing, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, well, if it was up to me, and if I was in charge of the EU, I would probably try and outlaw loyalty points of this kind altogether.
Do you think we're likely headed that way anyway?
Probably not. I mean, you know, where do you draw the line? If you go and buy a cup of coffee, you get a stamp on a card, and if you spend 100 quid on coffees, you get a little portion of milk or something.
So, I mean, in the interest of fairness, I'll read you what Tesco Bank said. So they said, as a result of changes in the credit card industry taking effect this year, the amount that card companies earn from businesses who accept credit cards is reducing. At Tesco Bank, we use that income to fund the club card benefits we give back to our customers. And as a result, we've had to make some changes to the amount of points our customers earn. While we are disappointed that the industry changes have resulted in the need to reduce the club card earn rate on our cards when they are used outside of Tesco, we have worked hard to ensure that our credit cards continue to offer great value for customers. We are committed to offering the most rewarding cards we can. So basically, it's if you're spending outside Tesco. If you're still spending inside Tesco, where they're able to harvest all your data, you keep the same points level. And I think probably if you've got a Tesco credit card, a club card, and you're very upset about this, or if you've got any other rewards scheme where you get very upset about something, the classic one was when they changed the Air Miles to the Avios thing a few years back, is you have to just chalk it up to experience, say, well, did I do all right out of that before? And then look at the future and go, is it worth me keeping this? And if it's not worth you keeping it, is there something better that you can get elsewhere?
You want to outlaw them, though, Rich?
Well, talking of Air Miles, I mean, a few years ago, or many years ago now, I ticked all the boxes, saved up all the Air Miles for 2 flights to Paris. And because clause 17 out of 34 clauses I hadn't ticked, I ended up going to Paris by myself.
Oh, Rich.
So this has clouded my view of loyalty points.
You still got to Paris, though. It's not bad.
Alone,
but
I mean, I don't have a Nectar card. I don't have a club card. In my view, life is too short for loyalty points, which is a completely stupid outlook to take, I must admit.
It's like when everybody
says about a cashback website, I'm not interested in cashback websites. I just can't be bothered. They're like, you could save money. I'm like, life's too short to save money.
Morning Money. The markets, the papers and the city. Today's Need to Know on Share Radio.
Every morning from 6 to 9, tune in to Morning Money on Share Radio.
With Sandra Kilhoff and Mark Johnson.
An in-depth look at the UK and global markets and business.
Giving you all the day's need to know.
Morning Money.
Getting you ready for the day ahead.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
Good morning, warm welcome if you've just joined us today. In the studio with me, editor Simon Lambert and journalist Rich Browning from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website. Coming up, may the force be with you to make it through to Christmas season, as it will be dominated by film merchandise. But first, what do you think of when you hear the word auction? Perhaps a multi-million pound painting or Fabergé egg going under the hammer at Sotheby's or Christie's, or David Dickinson's Real Deal, where apparently they travel the country looking for your, I quote the show blurb here, Bobby Dazzlers. But there's more to auctions and what you could buy at them than you might think. In fact, if you are unlucky, you may actually recognise some of it. So from forgotten luggage at Heathrow to property seized by the police, there's apparently a bargain to be had. Now, Rich, I'm assuming this is not a case of people nicking bags from luggage carousels, or perhaps the police seizing goods, selling them off straight away without trying to trace the original owners or anything of that dodgy nature.
I'm sure that goes on the dark side of the internet, but no, this is about lost luggage. There's millions of it that then gets sold off at auction.
How long is it kept for? I'm assuming this is stuff that's been kept around for a very long time, I imagine.
No.
What?
No. Okay, and I will quote Cara Gamble, who wrote this story for The Mail on Sunday and Us. If you've ever been left standing in front of an airport carousel waiting for a piece of luggage that never arrived, you may be surprised to know that just 3 months later, the contents could be up for auction.
Where? Where are these happening?
South London Greasby's auctioneers sell some 2,400 suitcases a year. If the original owners cannot be tracked down or don't show up to reclaim the bags, they are shipped off and sold. Another auction house, Bristol Commercial Valuers and Auctioneers, sells suitcases abandoned in the southwest. But there is a slight snag as a buyer. You do not know what is inside the case until you have handed over your cash. Isn't that brilliant?
It's like a lucky dip.
It is like a lucky dip. But to be fair, 3 months, you should have tracked your luggage down by that point. And if you haven't tracked your luggage down, and we hear all kinds of horror stories, and so I could understand there will be some that slip through the net, but you should probably have managed to track your luggage down within 3 months. The other one that we featured here is Bumblebee Auctions, which is the police seized, stolen, or just abandoned goods. And I've looked on Bumblebee a number of times in the past, actually, for bikes. They sell a lot of bikes. Now, what I've noticed on Bumblebee is basically any form of decent bike, half-decent bike that goes up for sale actually gets bid on pretty quickly and up to a relatively high price. And at first I thought, well, who's paying all this money for these second-hand bikes? And then I realised that the people paying this money for second-hand bikes are people who know that the second-hand bikes are worth some money. So I don't think this is people like you or me. These are people who have got a trade in buying a second-hand bike, fixing it up, and then selling it on for a 20, 30 quid profit, which must be a nice little earner, I would suspect.
So I do like the fact that you've even gone as far as to talk about the Sales of Good Act, and apparently it does not apply to auctions. So a bit of a word of warning, if you do find a bike, you do not have the same consumer rights that you would have when purchasing from a normal retailer. Apparently, if you bid at auction, you enter into a legally binding contract to buy upon the fall of the auctioneer's gavel.
Have you ever been to an auction?
Do you know what? I never have.
Oh, auctions are awesome.
It's terrible, though, because all the auction houses, because it's moving online, are closing down. But if you buy something in an auction, like furniture that we bought over the years, you've got your own story, because you can remember bidding for it and how exciting it was. And, of course, there's probably a story from where it has been before. And I do like that.
You should go to a property auction, basically. So you have them regularly, you know, across the country, but they have quite a lot of them in London. They're free to attend, and basically, all human life is there. The whole world walks past you. It's absolutely compelling. We did a video a couple of years back where I went along to an auction. We spoke to the auctioneer and we spoke to some of the people buying property there. And it's really great. It's great entertainment. You know, you can just walk in, be there for an hour or so, watch the thing unfold and then leave. And the thing about auctions is, a classic piece of advice is, A, if you are going to buy something in an auction, make sure that you have previously attended an auction in your life, because it's very easy to not know what's going on and get carried away. And it's not the problem of accidentally scratching your nose and you've bought a house or a car, because that doesn't happen. Auctioneers are professionals. They pride themselves on not selling houses to people scratching their noses. But there is this sort of element of how it ebbs and flows. And also there's advice about basically knowing what your top price is and not getting caught up in the moment and going over it and being in a bidding war.
So this is
why
I don't think
it was sensible. And also looking at trying to catch who's bidding and trying to see whether they're, you know, an amateur or a professional. The professionals will probably have set a price and they'll duck out. But the amateurs are the people who can get caught up in a bidding war. And if you're an amateur going up against an amateur, you could very easily actually end up paying more for something at auction than you would do just buying it in normal life. So, and that's true of houses, of cars, of pictures, and possibly of suitcases full of stuff that you don't need.
I'm getting such an insight into your personality here, and how you get your kicks, Simon. Coming up, though, we'll stick with the property theme, and it's not so grim up north.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Well, so far we've looked at banking technology, the rise of contactless cards, Tesco getting stingy perhaps with club card points, and how to bag a rather unusual bargain at auction. But now let's take a look at the world of homes and property. And coming up, we'll be discussing if leasehold properties are just a lucrative way to stop people owning their own homes outright. And also fancy a psychometric test to get a mortgage. But first, where would you say is the best place to bring up a family? Well, according to a new survey on This Is Money, the crown goes to the small village of Higher Whitley near Warrington, if you didn't know. So what has Higher Whitley got that other places don't? And indeed, how do we judge where is the best place to bring up a family? Rich, Simon, have you ever been to Higher Whitley or indeed Warrington? What is so special about it?
I can't admit that I have actually been to Higher Whitley in Warrington. But basically, this is a report that's been done by this website called propertydetective.com. And it's quite interesting because what they've done is they've assessed the best places to raise a family. They've looked at the quality and availability of schools, nurseries and childcare providers, NCT groups, crime rates and population density. NCT groups, yes. The National Childbirth Trust. These are the groups that parents sign up to for some antenatal classes before birth. And they don't do it to actually learn anything about the birth. They do it to meet other people, and it's a huge favourite of the middle classes, and it's a nice way for middle class mums and middle class dads to meet other middle class mums and dads. Interestingly, we were going to do NCT, but my first daughter was born 4 weeks early, the day before the NCT class, so I managed to get out of it, which was awesome.
And you've thanked her ever
yeah,
since.
Exactly. Funnily enough, in some of these rankings, basically, the fact that there's a good NCT network has managed to bump somewhere into this top 100. This list, the top 10, is absolutely dominated by places that are in the north or the Midlands, which to me is in the north.
I noticed, and there's one in the south, is there
not? No, there's two. There's two in the top 10 that are in the south. There's Flaundon, which is Hertfordshire, Buckinghamshire borders, and there's also a place in Southampton. And then there's, if you look further down the list, there are some that stack up here. And actually, it's quite funny to look down this list and go, well, do I know any of these places? And funnily enough, I do know a couple of these places that they're near in Hertfordshire, near where I originally come from. One of them is a place called East Hyde, which manages to come in at number 26. Now, East Hyde is quite a nice place. It's a little village between Harpenden and Luton, but it's a bit in sort of no man's land kind of territory. There's a large sewage works there and a quite busy road that runs through the middle of it.
Right.
And I don't know whether I would rank it as in the top 26 places in the country to bring up a child.
As long as they have an NCT class, that's all right.
Yeah,
sewage works,
exactly.
Fine, big but road, fine.
There's another one that's in St Albans, which I guess St Albans is probably a very nice place to bring up a family. But what's interesting is that if you were to go all out and say, right, I want to choose the best place in the country to bring up a family, then you should be heading north. And the great thing about heading north is it's cheaper.
Well, yeah, absolutely. So you can spend it on more things to start a family or raise a family. Because actually, there's two of these polls here. The best place to raise a family, which is Higher Whitley, and the best place to start a family, which is Bollington. So
yes,
you can start in Bollington and move to Higher Whitley.
Yeah, I mean, it provides the perfect opportunity, doesn't it? So you can start and then move. But it does raise that really interesting question of what makes a good place to live? Why is a place a good place to live? So I've lived in the same area for 10 years now in London, and I really like it. And we've lived in three different flats there. We lived in a rental flat for the first 9 months, then we bought our first flat, and then we moved to our current one 4 years ago. It takes me 40 minutes to cycle to work. There's lots of nice parks. You can get to bits of sort of green space. Like, there's this thing called the Parkland Walk, which is basically an old railway line. It's like been in the countryside, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. the main shopping street. It's got lots of independent businesses and stuff like that. And then also the fact that, you know, we've got kids now, the schools are reasonably good, and it's just a nice atmosphere. I know that when I walk into the shops, I know the people in the shops, they know me, we say hello to each other, and it's got a nice feel to it. And I think that's what makes a place a nice place to live, is whether it's got that feel to it. And Rich has been living in his house for even longer than I have.
I was going to say, shame about the parking, though.
Yeah, shame about the parking.
Yeah, but we won't talk about that. Rich, doesn't it come down to that old question? Is it village? Is it town? Is it city?
I've got two vested interests here, actually. Those two top places to bring up and start the family are in Cheshire, which is where I was born. And the Whitley place has only got a population of 533 people. So there are probably 33 kids and 500 people employed in childcare. but where I live was in one of these surveys a few years ago, and it was voted through Crime Stats and Green Spaces the best place to live in the country. A couple of weeks later, there were two murders.
Oh.
But it has got everything you need. I mean, same house we've been in for 21 years. And it's a bit like Trumpton, you know, the fire station's in the right place, the windmill's in the right place. There's just good connections, public transport.
Does it have an NCT course, though, there?
Oh, it's got loads.
Yeah, probably. Well, let's talking of housing and children, we'll go on to one of the stories that's been doing the rounds quite a lot this week, and that's parents spending nearly £41,000 extra moving house to be closer to England's top-performing state schools. Now, Lloyds say that property prices in the postcode areas of the country's 30 highest-ranked secondaries were that much more expensive on average. Also, Santander brought out a poll earlier this week that said some people in London are spending £70,000 to be near a good catchment area. We spoke to TV presenter and mum of two, Andrew McLean.
My son is a teenager now. He's in secondary school. And I definitely know that when I was considering the schools that he was going to be moving into for the latter half of his education, that yes, I took into account the last move that I made, was around 3 years ago, that he was in the catchment area for the best school in our local area. So I think it's something that all parents do to varying degrees, whether you're a busy mum working around the country or whether it's just within your local environment. We all do it. Sacrifices are made all round. I mean, obviously, I now commute into London rather than living a lot closer to my work. That's one of the sacrifices that I've made. The area that I've moved to, the houses are actually cheaper rather than living in London. And it was a balance, I think, of bearing in mind the schools that my kids were potentially going to go to, I may have had to pay private fees for, and balancing up whether I could afford that to send them to a good school or moving home. On balance, it actually worked out economically better, trying to do the best that you can for your kids. And I'm sure I'm not alone in that.
Simon, I'm going to come to you on this one. Was it a factor for you getting your kids into a good school, moving near a good catchment area?
No, it wasn't actually when we moved. We moved when my daughter was about 9 months old. But we knew that there were a number of good primary schools. There was quite a lot of primary schools in the area, and most of them are good. And in fact, actually, from going around the primary schools, what you realise is that, especially in London now, most primary schools are now good. And actually, schools in London have gone from being quite bad to really quite good. And if you are in London, you're probably in a better position than people in many areas of the country. So no, we didn't consider it. I think it's probably something you definitely have to consider if we moved again in terms of secondary school. And I mean, one of the factors that comes into play here is basically houses near secondary schools are expensive, good secondary schools. But as long as that good secondary school doesn't turn into a terrible secondary school, you'll probably make the money back when you sell the house.
Rich, you?
A bit dull, really. I mean, the same story. We lucked out and moved into a place with really good schools all around.
I think consider paying £30,000 to move if you weren't?
No, because what I've learned is to sort of question, actually, what makes a good school? And there's a lot of schools that try so hard to get to the top of the tables. And you sort of lift the bonnet up and it's like, hang on a minute, the schools down the road are just as good, if not better than this.
What exacerbates the problem, actually, I think, is that it's the cost of private school nowadays. Like, private school fees are really, really expensive nowadays. They've risen way above wages and way above inflation. That's a factor of this sort of increasing inequality in the country, where the very wealthy have got quite a lot wealthier and everyone else hasn't really got that much wealthier. And so if the cost of private school is now, I think on average, it's like 10 grand a year, probably for like some of them would be 15 or something like that. If the cost of that private school is that much, then when people weigh up the, is it worth moving to that more expensive house near that really good state secondary school, then it becomes more worthwhile than paying more for that house, because the gap between that and the private school fees is much bigger now. And also, as I said, when you sell the house, you'll get the money back. You can't sell your child at the end of their education and get their private school fees back.
We're going to stick with property very quickly, and I'm going to turn to an article from one of your colleagues. Now, this is on leasehold property. So Sam Dunn questions whether they're just a lucrative way of stopping people from owning their homes outright. He said, "I did what many people do when I first heard about the concept of leasehold. I scratched my head in disbelief." He asked if more needs to be done to protect leaseholders. So, Simon, if you would just explain to us what leasehold properties are, how they work, and what's got under Sam Dunn's skin.
There's two ways of owning a property. Freehold, which means that you own the house and the land that it sits on, and leasehold, which means that you own the property in terms of what you live in, but that you're actually only own it for a certain period of time, the length of the lease, which would normally be, let's say, 100 years or something, and that a landlord, the freeholder, actually owns the building itself. And this is most common with flats. So normally a house will be freehold and a flat will be leasehold. That's the traditional way it's always been done. And so you would have a landlord who owned the building, and then the flats within it over 100 years were leasehold. And as those leases went down, that would erode the value of the flat. And once they get below a certain level, mortgage lenders don't like lending on them and people get very nervous about buying them. So if you get below about 70 or 80 years, the advice generally is to renew the lease, at which point the freeholder can turn around and demand a large sum of money. Now, there's been some stuff done to crack down on this. In terms of there's this process called enfranchisement, where you can try to buy the freehold. So our flat is share of freehold, which means that the individual flats actually own the freehold themselves, so we all own a share of it. And there's a lot more of that that's happened over time. But there is countless stories of people being asked for huge sums of money as leaseholders by what could be described as unscrupulous freeholders. And the reason why this came up and Sam wrote this column is because Money Mail did an expose on a town called Cramlington up in the northeast, where, funnily enough, a lot of the houses are leasehold. Three quarters of the houses they reckon are leasehold, which is highly unusual. So a lot of these people with these houses are finding it difficult to get a buyer, or they're finding the leases are going down and they want to renew them and they're being asked for large sums of money.
I see. Well, let's move on to it's all about lending, because lenders are getting personal. When you think of things perhaps that you need to get a loan, you know, a mortgage maybe, your bank details, your address, good credit rating, collateral, maybe a spot of charm. What about the right personality? Well, borrowers who are looking to apply for mortgages, credit cards, personal loans could soon face what's called a psychometric test, aimed, they say, at helping the banks check how dependable you are in making payments. The answer could be fed into a computer, which would spit out a trustworthiness rating. So, Rich, I'm going to go to you first on this one. A psychometric test, really? What are they? What sort of things are going to be asked of us?
Tries to look into my personality. I don't think I'm going to get anything. But
would the computer say no, Rich?
Well, funnily enough, I did one of these a couple of weeks ago. It was a new psych, one of these tests to see if you're suitable for investing or whether you need an advisor because you're incapable of doing it yourself. And I went through all this process, and the questions you're asked were just, there was really complicated maths questions, and then,
oh wow,
and it was, how would you answer this, how would you react to this, and then the results, because you actually get to see the results, it's not like the bank manager's getting it and then saying no, bore absolutely no relation to what I think I'm responsible at as an investor. So to do this to see whether you're eligible for a loan, I think is outrageous. But for people with no credit rating, they do need something, because and so if they can ask a few clever questions to see if you're actually, even though you won't admit it, going to spend all your money in the pub every night, then that's probably something worth considering. But I don't like these at all.
Well, yeah, it's quite interesting. So it works on, I guess the way to look at this is it works on two levels. Some of this stuff, this new version of checking whether people can afford a loan. On one level, you've got the lower end of borrowers or the mass borrower who basically it's like, is there a better way of assessing people than their credit rating? So famously, Wonga's special sauce, other than extremely high interest rates on payday loans, was this algorithm, which meant it could make a lending decision on you very, very quickly, and it could put the money into your bank account very, very quickly. And it didn't use traditional credit scoring. It used all these different points of data that it, you know, meshed into this algorithm, which is why Errol Damlin, the founder, was very keen to suggest it was a tech firm, not a extremely expensive payday lender. But it was a special source. And it's like, is that a better way of checking up on people? With the psychometric testing, what's interesting is that maybe you shouldn't be doing this to everyone, but should you be doing it to people who want to borrow large sums of money? Like, so you've got your standard mortgage lending sort of brackets, and then you've got someone who wants to borrow above that, on the basis that they've got good career prospects. And actually, there is an argument that says you can afford to lend something like a secured loan, a large mortgage, to someone who has good career prospects, is going to progress in their life, because their salary is going to escalate at a much faster level than other people. And so they will be able to pay it back. So the 10 questions we've got here are: my goals in life are clear. I'm not sure that's even a question. It's just a statement, isn't it?
Yeah. These are your questions.
No, these are the questions, the 10 questions to analyse you that were suggested. These were things that people would, statements that people would be asked to agree with, I guess. Mm. My goals in life are clear. If people are rude, I shrug it off. I'm confident in what I do. I can work even when things are disorganised. I consistently put time and effort into everything I do. I tend to take on other people's problems. I prefer working in a stable rather than flexible environment. I am ambitious. It's better to get the job done than aim for perfection. I feel uneasy if I'm the centre of attention. So, do you know how you should answer those?
Just to pick out on one of those questions, are you confident? I clicked that and said, yeah, I'm pretty confident. And then you get the results and it says, ah, you're too confident.
Exactly. How do you answer these things?
But maybe you should, maybe you should have help investing, but you should be allowed to borrow some money.
And also, there's tons of psychometric books out there on the market. Can you not just cheat?
Well, I would imagine that if you were the kind of person who knew about these things, and bear in mind, lots of people will have had job interviews where they might have had this kind of stuff, then they might know how to answer them. There is definitely an art to answering them. I've never had to do a psychometric test, but I do have friends who've been in careers where they've had more job interviews that have this kind of thing. And I bet they'd be much better at knowing the right answer to put down than me. Mm-hmm.
Now, get ready, though. We're going to change subject. The Force is about to be awakened. Wondering how many times I've played the Star Wars theme tune here on Consuming Issues. Yes, too many, I imagine. Yes, that's right. If you've been anywhere near the TV, radio or internet, or indeed any electronic device in the last few months, you'll know there is a new Star Wars film coming out this Christmas. Some people are pretty excited about it. But not everyone. Yep. But I'm afraid either way, the fact is you are going to have to deal with it. Research at the Autumn Fair in Birmingham predicts Star Wars merchandise will be top of the most wanted charts for Christmas. Indeed, Disney, which bought out the Lucasfilm franchise for $4 billion, apparently so keen to cash in they were. They dubbed today Force Friday, the first time you can see and buy all the toys, collectibles, books and other such merchandise unveiled in the shops and live on YouTube. You can't blame them, as fans have spent $20 billion on Star Wars merchandise since the film first came out in 1977. So you two have been looking into this. Star Wars fans, everybody, by the way.
I'm a Star Wars fan. Looking I don't think I'd pay £99 for a mug, though.
Yes, exactly, which leads us on to £99 for a mug. Does it make tea for you?
OK, right, so I should clarify here that this is not actually officially a mug.
All right.
The manufacturers of this refer to it as mug.
Is it a mug if you buy this?
What a number of readers have commented. So, yes, you could suggest that if you bought this, you had been mugged off. But no, this is actually a tankard. This is a pewter tankard. But they did refer to it as Star Wars pewter tankard, mug. And a lot of readers have said you would be a mug to pay for this. But someone has said, if you keep it in the original box and refrain from drinking from it, it could easily be worth double in less than 25 years. Few other investments can give that type of return.
Simon, in your experience as writing the minor investor column, a good investment? Nowadays, given how much stuff they must be pumping out at the moment.
So what I check up on is how many of these things are they making, right? So if they're only making 250 of them, then yeah, it probably would be a good investment. But if they're making as many as they can sell to the mugs who want to pay £99 for a mug, then no, it's probably not a good investment. And there's a brilliant comment on here, though, where someone says, Nanook of the North says much cheaper to pay £3 and get a Labour leader mug. Someone said, well, if Corbyn gets in, you can save the £3 and still have a mug, presumably because Corbyn will just give out free mugs for everyone.
So many jokes to be had, so little time in which to say them. Editor Simon Lambert, journalist Rich Brannan from This Is Money, thank you so much for joining us. You're listening to Consuming Issues.
This is Share Radio.